Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we get people from around the world to tell you how they saw the news in the past month. This is episode number 44 for February 2012. Hello everyone and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is the show where we sit around a table and invite you at that table. You might think, this is pretty common. I sit at tables all the time. Well, this table is kind of different because it spans continents. Yes, that's right. We get people from different parts of the world to sit down and discuss what's been going on in the world in the past month or so. And it's pretty cool because we get to have opinions and ideas and views from different cultures and countries. So hopefully it is interesting for everyone. Today, I might introduce myself maybe in case you haven't listened to the show before. My name is Patrick Béja. I live in France. That's about it for me. We also have Kerwin, who is in the UK at the moment, right? You're always traveling. I'm never sure.
This month I'm in London, yes. Hello, okay. Everybody.
Hey, Kerwin. And we also have Omri, who has been on the show before, just as Kerwin has. And Omri is splitting his life between the U.S. and Israel. So at the moment, you're in Tel Aviv, right?
Yeah, right now I'm in Ramat HaSharon, a small town north of Tel Aviv. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Thank you very much for being here, both of you. It's going to be interesting. I'm always glad to have Kerwin on the show, obviously, but I'm especially glad to have you, Omri, because we've been talking for a few months, even more than a year, about a lot of things that have been happening in the Middle East, and we haven't had a huge amount of feedback from the other side of the fence, if you might excuse that horrible joke, from the Israeli. So hopefully you can provide that for us, because again, we're going to be talking about the Middle East and more specifically about Syria.
Well, I'm not official speaker of the State of Israel. I'm speaking for myself, but
obviously.
I can tell you that I'll try to give my opinion, and I think the man in the street opinion.
So. Yeah, that's always what we're looking for in this show. We're trying to evaluate more or less how the people in that country, might see those situations rather than the official stated opinion. And we have the UN for that part, so we should be good. We're going to start with Europe, though. Someone is doing the dishes at your place, Omri.
Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. Yeah, I'm in a closed room, so.
Oh, okay. I don't know. I was hearing plates being shuffled. And that's how you know it's a real show, people. It's not just, journalists presenting their stuff from a cold, white room. It's real people. All right. So
at a table continents wide with plates and pots and pans the size of countries.
Yeah.
Exactly. So sit down, relax, have a coffee, and we're going to be together for a little bit over an hour, I'm guessing, maybe a little bit less. So let's start with the thing that has been occupying most of our month, at least here in France. It's Greece and the euro crisis. It seems I'm not going to go into all the details about Greece anymore. We've been talking about it for months and months. But it seems that the euro crisis part of it has been pretty much constrained to Greece, at least for the month. I mean, obviously, Italy and Spain are mostly they're not, in a good shape, but they haven't been the main concern. The main concern have been Greece itself and the fact that they were being difficult, and by that I mean they were hanging on to dear life, for dear life, to some of their benefits. And finally, after weeks of protest and really difficult political situation, both in Greece, and I didn't mention Turkey isn't here. Well, he's not here. He'll be back next month, I'm sure. So both for Greece and for Europe, at the European Union, it's been incredibly difficult because the European Union has been offering more money to the Greek government in order to avoid the default of the government, but they've been asking with even more insistence than before for guarantees and assurances that the money would be well spent, that the spending would be reduced as much as possible, and by what we hear from the Greek people demonstrating in the street, even more than what's possible and reasonable. So it's sort of a we're not sure exactly what to think situation here, because on the one hand, what I've been saying before is definitely a feeling that we have, which is they are responsible for what's happening, for being in this situation, just as, you know, other countries have been spending too much and maybe not being rigorous enough. And Greece seems to have been the worst of those. So they should make an effort, but at the same time, it looks like it's so hard and they're cutting so much that we're sort of feeling sorry for what's happening. But I don't know that we have any other solution than being incredibly harsh. But Kerwin, I guess the UK is a little bit outside of that issue somewhat, because obviously you don't have the euro. You're not part of the monetary union. So is that just as big of a concern in the UK, or not as much?
I think that for most of the population, it's a foreign issue because we're not in the euro. I think for the government that they are concerned about what's going on, because even if the currencies are separate, the European and British economies are thoroughly enmeshed with each other. Yeah. And where the euro goes, the pound goes quite a long way as well. The British economy.
So
I think that, David Cameron is pushing in the background for whatever he thinks this is the right answer to him. I think that he shot himself in the foot a little while ago, if you remember a couple of months ago, where he vetoed some of the previous packages that Sarkozy and Merkel were trying to push through. And I think he's realized that was a diplomatic mistake.
So is it, but what about people around you, the general feeling? Is it, well, it's their own damn fault, those dirty Greeks, or is it like, oh my God, we're bleeding the Greeks and they're, you know, there's no way they can take that for much longer?
I think the people are going to see those kinds of austerity measures as similar, well, not much worse than what's happening in the UK, but it's paralleling what's happening in the UK at the moment. There's a lot of people talking here about quite actively using the phrase, you know, the social contract is being torn up, or it's being rewritten, the welfare state is actively being dismantled, like quite consistent effort to dismantle the welfare state at the moment from the conservative government. So I think that a lot of the people here can sympathize entirely with the way the Greek people are reacting. I was talking to someone about the issue of the Greek sovereign debt crisis.
Can you speak a little bit louder, Kerwin? You're a bit quiet.
Okay. Is this any better? Is it the microphone?
No, I think you're just your voice. You're so silky smooth.
The British accent. I wish I had one.
That's all right. Okay, I'll speak louder. Thanks. So one of the things that we were discussing a couple of days ago is that the debt that Greece contracted, the the government of Greece contracted. Well, there were two parties to that debt. There was the government borrowing, and there were the creditors as well. And huge amounts of this debt, I believe, was contracted from banks and other private sources. The European Union is not putting pressure on those counterparties to the debt to carry any of the burden of this crisis. So
I see.
In that way, it looks as though, well, this is just another way in which the European economies, or the Western economies, however you want to put it, are beholden to the big banks, beholden to this mentality that the banks are too big to fail, etc., etc. So I think that there's a lot of parallels between what happens in Greece and what happens here. I think it plays out more dramatically in Greece. I suppose people look at Greece as a foreign issue because there's enough things to worry about here. And the euro does mean that it's not a kind of solidarity, but it's something that we understand quite well, I would say.
Sure. I'm sorry, your sound quality is kind of not very good, so I don't know if we can fix that on the fly. What kind of mic are you using?
I'm using a headset.
Okay, maybe put the mic closer to your mouth if you can.
It's kind of touching.
Okay. All right, we'll manage. Omri, what about yourself? I mean, obviously, Greece is, you know, very sort of part of the Mediterranean, so it might be a little bit closer geographically, even though it's in the, the EU and has little to do economically with you guys. Is the euro crisis a concern for Israel, or not even?
Well, it is a concern, and I think people here feel for the Greek people. It's I don't think it's a fun situation. I think the source for this problem is that not all economies are the same, right? And but you all have the same currency, and that's a problem. And most government now don't have control over the currency; they can't deflate it. Israel had a similar problem in the 80s: high debt and problem. But we had control over our own currency, so we could deflate it, make a new currency, and together with austerity measures. It solved the problem, but unless Greek get out of the eurozone, it can't actually do that. It's beholden to the euro. It's not, sure. It's not what the American or the British can do. They can just print more money, and it's like a soft default. They are defaulting by giving you the same amount of money, but the money worth less. But
it's actually, there's a lot of people apparently in economic circles that would, at least in France, who would really like to, from what I understand, everyone except for Germany would like to do that, would like to make inflation happen, and that would solve everything. But Germany is sort of very much afraid of that because, I guess, of images of,
the Weimar
buckets
Republic,
of money and... What? Sorry?
Images of the Weimar Republic, images
exactly,
of the...
Buckets of money to buy a potato, basically, that... So, yeah, definitely that would be something we could... But that's the way... You guys did it in the 80s when you had that issue.
Yeah, well, it's not a magic bullet. There are winners and losers in any situation like that. Yeah. But as you said, when somebody borrow money, somebody is giving the money.
Yeah.
And it's a contract, and it's a dangerous contract. Every time you give money to somebody, there is a chance of default.
Yeah.
So it has to be priced in the money. And they should take, right now what Europe is doing is bailing out the people who loan the money on the top of the Greek people. Now, it might be the Greek people, own problem. They actually borrowed money.
Yeah, that's the thing. If the Greeks didn't have a solid managing of their economic situation, then it feels like it's their fault and it's horrible, but,
No, think about before Greek joined the Eurozone, it had its own currency, the drachma, which was worth much less. So Greek export was much cheaper. They could export things, and the economy was smaller, because the currency was cheaper.
Yeah.
And now they have a very strong currency and they are not as competitive. So that's sure. another problem.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So it's not as, you know, black and white, I guess. So do you talk a lot about the euro crisis in Israel?
Not much. It's more about, you know, the price of the shekel compared to the dollar or the euro and the trends and, you know, we're a small economy. We're worried about what happened because Europe is the biggest, Israel, the biggest exporter is Europe. So we export to Europe more than anywhere else. So we care about what happens there.
Mm. So talking about what has been your primary concern, I'm guessing for the past year or so, I mean, you've lived mostly in the U.S. from what I understand, or maybe split your time. But for Israel, there must have been a lot of crazy months in the past year. You had a little bit of time on the show a few months ago, but we haven't really had time to explore that aspect of things a lot. And certainly with the Arab Spring and what's happening now, Israel has been both. So, okay, basically, freedom, democracy, all of that is super good, and I'm sure everyone is happy about that. On the other hand, democracy in Arab countries often brings, you know, Islamic regimes. And the Muslim Brotherhood has proven that, you know, I mean, the examples we've had have proven that the Muslim Brotherhood is usually the one that ends up in power. Now, they might be saying, we want to institute a tolerant version of the Islamic law, but it's still definitely a concern specifically for Israel. So how have things been received and how have people, you know, received all of these series of uprisings and revolutions that are by themselves good news, but
So people here are very you know, don't know exactly how to think about that. On one hand, as you said, everybody is for democracy and very hopeful that good things will happen. On the other hand, you see, you know, take two countries, for example. You have Egypt and Syria, okay? Yeah. In both countries, you have secular despots that rule over the country. In Egypt, the despot was more fair. You know, we had a cold peace treaty with Egypt and we had a warm relationship specifically with the leader of Egypt. Mm. In Syria, we have a cold war, so it's not a peace, but there is a very stable border there.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the Syria despot is a friend of Iran and is helping Hezbollah. So, and then what happened in Egypt? We lost. It's not you know, our doing, but. I mean, I'm personally very happy for the Egyptian people. You know, get democracy, as people said, it's the worst kind of, you know, it's a worse way to rule yourself, but it's better than anything else. So,
yeah.
And freedom is better than anything else. And when you have despot, you get Muslim bravoship. You get all the craziness, you know, growing. So we're happy for them, but then look at who won. And look at the problem we have ever since. We had the gas treaty where we get cheap Egyptian gas to power most of Israel, and they just blew up the gas pipe for like 10 times. So we can't rely on that. So the electricity prices in Israel has been going up like 50%.
Mm. In the past, you know, you mean in the past 4 months or so?
Oh yeah, because we can't. We were pretty reliant on Egyptian gas until we can develop our own gas finding in the Mediterranean.
Mm.
In Syria, it's a different matter. In Syria, it's like a lose-lose situation. So right now, we have a despot that is a friend of Iran and Hezbollah, and nobody likes him. On the other hand, he keeps a border at least with the Syria stable. But then, you know. I personally would love to have him, you know, I see the pictures as everybody else. I would love him to get out of power.
Mm.
But then, of course, we're worried we'll get the same scenario like Egypt. But I don't think it can be worse than what we have right now. So
yeah. So basically, in general, it's hard to say, as you're saying, I'm sure people are not exactly sure what to think. But let's look at it like that. This is the situation going to be worse for Israel now that you know, these countries have democracy?
I don't think Muslim... so. I trust in the people. I really do. I think that going to the Muslim Brotherhood is a knee-jerk. It's, you know, they were the opposition during the long secular rule of a despot. So I think it's a counter-movement. And if people have, I don't think they'll break the peace treaty, which is the most important thing to us. But and then, you know, people ruling themselves, especially now with social networks, and you can't really hide what's happening. And I hope that over time, you know, they'll get a better life and we'll get warmer. I think democracies can work together better than democracy in a despot.
Okay. All right.
I'm cautiously optimist.
I think it mirrors a lot of people's thoughts in here too, as we've talked a few times already. Kerwin, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that your concerns about the instability that might result are quite heavily economic, as well as perhaps political. But I think when looking from the outside world, looking from the English-speaking world, when you think, what's Israel going to think about the Arab Spring around it? Is it going to think, well, this is a political threat to the state of Israel? And you're saying, well, it's really more, in the short term at least, a threat to the price of gas and other things like that. It's interesting that those are the effects that people might be more concerned of than what the outside world would perceive would be Israel's interests in this story.
Yeah, I guess that's an interesting point. You didn't mention we're afraid that all of a sudden everyone is going to, you know, start a war again. That's not even in people's minds.
Well, look at what happened in Egypt. You need to start a war, a real war in the 20th century or 21st century. We need a good economy. Mm. And they shot their economy in the foot. So I don't think we're worried about armies marching to our borders. And I think, again, the Israeli army, I think, can handle real armies, not, popular movements. So I don't think we're worried about war per se. We are more worried about, if you're talking about external threat, Iran, Hezbollah, Hamas in the Gaza Strip, and the threat of rockets from all three borders, and especially instability from Syria, which was a very stable, Syria and Egypt, both of them were very stable borders.
Sure.
And of course, what would happen to the Jordanian despot? You know, he's a king, right? He's a despot king. And the majority there is Palestine. So, again, the same thing as in Syria. So he can fall also. So, again, he's a half-friendly despot. And
I think that's the case, for pretty much everyone. Of course, Israel is a lot more directly impacted by all of those. But everyone, we had good relationships with all of those despots now, you know, after a few decades of difficult situations, we sort of got around to being on okay terms. I don't even want to say friendly terms, but although that would be appropriate in some cases. So, you mentioned Syria, and obviously that's been a huge part of the news cycle, and Syria and the fact that the UN is now actively pushing for resolutions against the Assad family. Hamas, you were mentioning them, has come out against the Assad family very recently, a couple of
days ago. Which is very funny because their whole political leadership were hosted at Syria.
Yeah, so... Well, the thing is, things are really... I think last month we were mentioning that we couldn't really see how things were going to evolve in anything other than probably something pretty bad for the Assad family and the regime in Syria. And it seemed like it was going to turn into a full-out civil war. And it looks like we're now in the first steps of that civil war with active fighting and the UN discussing how to arm maybe the opposition. And the only two holdouts to being more active in that conflict are Russia and China. both.
Well, there are several points. I'm sorry. There are several points about Syria that you need to discuss. One, it's nothing new. The father of the current Syrian despot also had a rebellion, and he crushed it very forcibly.
Are you saying that you think it might still be crushed?
There is 2 points to that. One, I think he saw what happened in other countries, what happened to the defeated leaders in other countries. And the second point is that in Syria you have a minority ruling over the majority. And the minority, I think, fear very much what would happen if they lose power. Mm. So I think they will fight very strongly, because I think they know what happened if they lose. So that's a big problem.
Mm.
I don't think he thinks he have anything to lose.
He always has something to lose. He could lose, you know, his head, for example.
Well, ugly head, I can say that.
Sure, but I'm sure he likes it nonetheless. But, you know, that's basically what we've been hearing the past couple of days, is the only way out now would be for Syrian officials, for, you know, the Assad family to agree to stop everything, to leave power, and then there would be a general, you know, blanket amnesty for everything that has happened, and that's the only way that it could end without a lot more blood being shed.
I think it's such a bigger thing than you think. It's also a dispute between Hezbollah and Iran on one side, helping the Syrian president. On the other hand, you have Qatar and Saudi Arabia helping the rebels. So it's a war between wars. So it's more than just a simple conflict.
And also, if it's minority ruling over majority, if Assad leaves and he and his entourage have amnesty, what then happens to the minority?
I think they would need to. Well, I don't know. We're delving into conjecture here, but you know, there would need to be. I don't know how you call those, but in French we say réconciliation nationale, which is basically a system where after civil war, a heavy conflict, you go around and you say, all right, now we're completely done. No one kill anyone. We stop. And, you know, that's it. Now we're friends now. And
which is what they did in Rwanda and what
exactly,
they've done in South Africa.
Yeah.
But that's not something that I've heard much talk about in any of the Arab nations, in any of the Arab Spring, a national truth commission.
Well, because none of them stopped. All the, you know, well, most of the leaders there went to the end. They just didn't want to give up, and so they ended up in a ditch somewhere. To be completely clear, it doesn't really look, at least what we're hearing, is that it doesn't look at all like Assad is going to give up. So this is just, how could we make it work? Maybe. It's not, this is the plan. So tell us about, you know, Turkey, Kerwin, how has this, I'm sure it's been, you know, the main news item everywhere for you guys too, right?
It's been a big news item, but in terms of the attitudes, when I was asking someone about this issue a few weeks ago, came up with a really good phrase, which is Arab Spring fatigue. I mean, it's a neat phrase for what's quite a horrible thing, really, that I think in some ways the parts of the British population have moved on from the issue, which is, you know, something that we do from a position of incredible privilege and safety and security on this little island, to say, you know what, we're just tired of hearing about it. But I think that's true in some ways, that the Arab Spring was a particular moment, and in some ways it's no longer part of the contemporary moment now. So even in academic discourses, I'm starting to see lectures and presentations and papers and things like that talking about the Arab world post-2011. Well, it's 2012 now. They're kind of consigning the Arab Spring to the past, and what we're left with now is issues that have kind of overstayed their welcome in the popular consciousness.
You mean Syria? Even Syria is not...
Yeah, it refers to Syria. You know, why did we intervene in Libya but not in Syria? Well, because in Libya we were full of energy and enthusiasm that we could change things. And in Syria, I think we just don't have that energy anymore for the issue.
And the cynicism can say that Libya is full of real energy, of oil, and Syria is not.
That might also play a small role. There's also another thing, which is a lot of people seem to be wary of the fact that in Libya, when we first started in Libya, we were saying there won't be an armed conflict and it will just be, you know, a little thing that will go in, will offer a little bit of assistance, but we won't do too much. And it turned, of course, into something a lot more active. So a lot of people seem to be saying, especially in, you know, Russia and maybe China, let's not do that again. Let's make sure we have a huge amount of, you know, we've exhausted every other possibility, and then we'll see what happens. So what about Israel with Syria? You know, is it just more of the same, or?
Yeah, as I told you, it's hard to know. You know, officially Israel, I think the official Israel would not like to see Assad go. It's a despot they can work with. He kept the border stable for a time, but it went into a point. I think that you know, it's the all options are bad. Even for official Israel, because he is supporting Hezbollah, he is supported by Iran. So, you know, if he go, I think it's uncertainty what would happen, but I don't think it could be worse than the point now. And I think the person in the street feels for the dying population there. It's not an easy sight to see.
Yeah. All right. I guess there isn't much more to say about Syria. Let's move on to Iran then, which very proudly showcased their advances in their nuclear program, and that, of course, once again prompted the international community to freak out because, you know, they're presenting it as civil use of nuclear energy, but of course we're very concerned that it might turn into a military use of nuclear, you know, technology. And more concerned than everyone else in the whole world, I guess, would be Israel, which is just a stone throw away, and Iran being less than friendly, it might turn into something very, very dangerous situation.
Well, you have to have a very strong arm to throw that stone. You have to cross through Iraq and Jordan to get to Iran. It's not that close.
No, certainly, but I mean, if they do develop, you know, nuclear missiles, it could definitely reach Israel.
Oh yeah, so that's so, like the you know, this is the drums of Iran is the. It's similar to me. I was in the U.S. when they were starting to drum up the Iraq war. So it's a similar feeling here. I personally believe that Israel's biggest problem is internal, not external. And especially with you know, very orthodox, very religious population inside of Israel, and changing from democracy to something else. That's something that I think worries me more than the threat of Iran. Officially, Israel is very worried about Iran. It's a country that's saying that they want to destroy us, and it's a religious rule that might not be a stable rule that knows the consequence of throwing an atomic bomb. Because I think it's...
There's a feeling that even if they do end up getting it, it's just for show and they would never use it, or...?
No, the worry is... It's the same with, you know, it's a religious, ultra-religious regime. Who knows what they're thinking? They might say it's a tenet from God to destroy Israel, and we don't care what happened to us, because I think they know that there'll be retaliation. I think for Israel it will be, you know, retaliation is funny. You know, it's not funny. It's
For you know, sorry?
No, for Israel, retaliation, right, after they bomb us, it's, you know, it's over for us, you know, so we can destroy them again, but that won't be very useful. I think Also, when you're looking in Israel, if they're really a friend, if the Iranian claim to be friend of the Palestinian, you can't really destroy Israel without destroying the Palestinian. You know, we are so close to each other. So that's, but again, and again, the another problem is that Hezbollah, Iran friend, is just there on our northern border. And it's not the, it's not the Lebanese government, right? It's just an organization. And if they get nuclear technology or weapons from Iran, that could be a threat that will just drive people away from Israel. You know, people will just be afraid to live here. That's one way to destroy it.
So, there is a fear that Hezbollah would get the technology from Iran directly?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Iran is giving them almost everything else. So
But that's not, you know, that for me, the first thing I go to when you're saying that, it's like, okay, you can have money and weapons, but a nuclear bomb is not something you would just hand off to, even if they're very close and they, you know, it seems like something. My first reaction would be, it seems like something even the Iranian government would not do.
Well, you're thinking as a rational human being, so
sure, okay.
That's the biggest problem. If they are rational, why they are destroying their own economy to and, you know, fighting all the world to get nuclear weapons? They are destroying their economy. Their currency was devalued by almost 50% in the last 2 years. They are in big troubles. Why do they take all this trouble to build so many nuclear sites, to dig them underground, to fight with the whole world just to get peacetime nuclear? And if it's not peacetime, why they are spending so much energy when, you know, what they want to do with it if they're never going to throw it?
There's been a number of I guess people and myself saying, well, not myself, but I mean, I've been hearing that Ahmadinejad is not that much of an extremist, and he's just doing these things as a token gesture towards the religious part of his party. Do you believe that's not necessarily the case, or is he now a hostage of the religious strengths in the country? Or
so what I'm hearing from, well, it's the Israeli newspaper, so who knows what the truth is? That there is a rupture between Ahmadinejad and the religious sect. So, you know, at least Ahmadinejad is not the leader of Iran; it's the Ayatollah who is the leader. So. And that they don't like what he's doing. And there is a lot of popular anger against him, especially because of economic reason, because the price of almost everything has been going up. And
So he would be the one driving the nuclear research, and the religious groups would not necessarily be for it, is what you're saying.
The thing is, who knows?
No, of course. But I mean, that's what's being reported by some.
It's been reported
That's a strange turn of things, because in my mind it would be the religious extremists that would be pursuing the nuclear research, and Ahmadinejad being sort of forced to do it if he wants to stay in power.
But they have their fake election pretty soon, and fake or not, it's still a populist anger against them. I think they're trying to divert the anger toward Ahmadinejad. So. Maybe they are for it, but they are just trying to remove themselves or to distance themselves from him. So, but I have to tell you, there is a lot of talk in Israel about do we bomb them or not, and it's become like a ritual. You can't open a newspaper without somebody saying something. And I think most Israelis are very split about it. I think I'm worried. I'm worried that
so it's a serious. It's a serious discussion now.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely a serious discussion. I think people are worried that they're going to actually do that, you know, our government, because, and again, it's a hard call, you know, when you have, sometimes, you know, it worked in Iraq. So famously, Israeli bombed the Iraq nuclear facility. But that's not the same as Iran. It's further away. They have much more than one site that you have to bomb. And I think Israel was focused for a long time on the, you know, killing Iranian nuclear scientists and sending, software viruses and all that.
Right, the Stuxnet thing.
Yeah, but I think
it's everyone agrees that it's Israeli engineered.
I think so. Well, nobody's actually saying
nobody
that.
Knows, of course.
Yeah, but... it's like a hink, hink, yes, right. So,
yeah, okay.
And so and that, you know, I think everybody in Israel, well, I don't know about killing scientists as one. I would not like them to start killing our scientists. But I think they agree that that's a good way to delay everything and to see if the diplomatic and pressure can work. But I'm worried. I think it's not just worried. I think they might do it after all, and that would be a hugely dangerous endeavor. So, and a stress point with us and the American. I don't think that they want, especially not in the election year, to face that. But I think I'm sorry. Just last point. I think that Netanyahu thinks that right now in an election year, it's the best way for him, because look at what happened in the recent Republican debate. They were fighting each other, except of Ron Paul, to say how much they support and that we should bomb them. And they will, if they were president, they would never, you know, stop us from bombing them and all of that. So I think he might say that now, before Obama gets reelected, is the best time to do it. So people here are, you know, that's a real thing that people are talking about.
Mm. Okay. So in the government, there are voices for and voices against, or is everyone like, well, we might have to do it?
Yeah, well, it's for and against all over the place.
Kerwin, what about the lovely UK?
I'm not sure how much this one registers. I guess the
really?
Thoughts are...
Wow. That's...
Well, not amongst the people. I'm not sure it registers in quite the same way. I have some thoughts about... there's a lot of sophistry about, well, if we can have the bombs, why exactly can't all of these other countries have the bombs, in the sense that if they shouldn't have it, shouldn't we all?
Yeah, there is a little bit of that here too, I have to say. I think it's a little bit naive to look at it like that, but certainly it does come out as an argument, yeah.
Well, one argument we'll put forward was, why do we trust Pakistan more than we trust Iran to have a bomb, for example? I mean,
I would say we don't trust anyone to have the bomb, but we're not happy to see, you know, one more person have it.
Right. So is it just this ratcheting that every next country that has it, we clamp down on? And then to what extent do we want to stop nuclear proliferation to... Because it seems to me that we only ever use soft power to stop it anyway. We use economic sanctions and other things, which have never been effective to stop any country doing anything.
I wouldn't necessarily agree, but yeah, I
mean,
see
like North Korea's nuclear program, for example, how much real effort have we put into stopping that compared to Iran? So it's perhaps less about the bomb per se, as the bomb proliferating in such a geopolitically sensitive area.
Yeah.
Which North Korea isn't, in a sense. China's more or less got North Korea under control if North Korea really gets excited with its bombs. And the US will back up South Korea. Mm. So, I don't know. I guess I can see a lot of value in that. I'm not sure how much I buy the argument that all of these governments will act irrationally, or the threat is that they will act irrationally. I don't think that that's the case. I think the bigger, the more realistic way to look at it is other governments will act rationally according to interests that aren't our own. And that you can't necessarily predict how another person will rationally see their own interests. So it will be a very well thought out strategic decision by any government or other organization who decides to launch a nuclear strike. We might not be able to see the logic of it, but that's not because it's an irrational decision.
Yeah.
I think that we can all agree that almost everyone in the world would be very happy if we have our Arab Spring in Iran.
You know, I don't know. Last time they had that, it was actually when they, you know, deposited the Shah and went into the Islamic
another one
regime. So
I guess that's the avenue we're looking at when we're seeing the Muslim Brotherhood come up. It is the Islamist side of the politic getting into power.
Yeah.
Again, I think it's a counter movement. So when you have a secular despot, you get a religious revolution. When you have a religious despot, you might get a secular revolution, but that might just be wishful thinking.
Hmm. Well, okay, I guess there's not much more to say about that. It's definitely one of the main concerns in the world in the past month, but... one of the other, there isn't anything else, right? It's almost for months now. Every time I start the lineup for the show, I'm like, all right, this is the same as it was last month.
There are good things, you know. I think that people are stuck in negativity too much. For example, just this week, a new book was released by Peter Diamantis. He's a co-founder of and the chairman of the XPRIZE. And also the co-founder of Singularity University, he came up with a great book. I think you should all read it. It's called Abundance, Why the Future is Better Than You Think.
Huh.
So it's not all just bad news. You know, I just read that. It was a shot of optimism. So I encourage all of you, you know.
I'm definitely one of those people who says, everyone always says, oh, it was better then, it was better now, you know, when I was young or stuff like that. I don't really understand those people.
There was no internet when I was young. I would never go back.
Well, you know, internet, of course, is one of the main things we see. It's like, you know, before electricity or before running water. It's like, to me, it's the three infrastructures that make our lives easier and better and richer. In all senses of the word. But even for other things, you know, there are a lot of people who say, kids today, they don't read anymore. And it seems to me like an incredibly narrow view of who the kids are and what, you know, what you think of when you're saying that. I
and
can't
what they
see...
read from.
Well, what they read is still another thing even. You might argue that they read a lot of blogs on the internet and that constitutes reading, and people might argue against it. But even if you say read actual books, there are an incredible number of people who read in you know, you go out in the subway and one out of three people is reading. And so when you're thinking before, you know, they didn't, people read more. When is that mystical before where people read? Is it like 20 years ago? I don't think so. It was, you know, the economic situation for the country, I'm talking about France as a whole, was very different back then. We might have had a middle class, maybe not 20 years ago, but even 30 years ago, a middle class that was very comfortable, but it wasn't as large, I would think, and they wouldn't have as much easy, their life wasn't as easy, I would think, in the sense that today you have a TV very cheaply, you have, you know, a gaming console, and you have an incredible phone that does everything for what is actually a very reasonable price.
Phone is the most important thing that you said. Phone, cellular phones are just the most amazing revolution ever. Think about farmers in Africa or in China or India that had a cellular phone. They have today better connectivity than the president of the United States had 25 years ago. And if they are connected to Google, they have more information.
No, absolutely.
But I mean, years ago.
You know, I'm talking about first world countries and people saying that before people read more. And I don't think that is the case. 50 years ago, people didn't even go to school. Children didn't even go to school. So I don't know where that mythical place of before exists. I
we
think it
in
only
amazing,
exists in people's minds, you know?
We live in an amazing time, and things are, you know, technology is just getting faster in an amazing way. So I spent the summer at Singularity University at NASA Ames. It's close to the Google headquarters in California. It's a whole university based on that technologies, at least information technologies, is accelerating exponentially. And people have a hard time even grasping what it means. You know, and the base case, the easiest thing to show is the computers, how a huge mainframe, you know, your cell phone is better than a huge mainframe like 20 years ago. Yeah. The huge advances, and just taking this line forward and what the future can have, you know, what kind of technologies we can have in the future to solve our global challenges. So I'm very optimistic about the future. I'm not worried so much.
I'm very, very optimistic as well. I mean, when I'm talking about the kind of convenient things we have, like TVs and things like that, it's really for... I'm really trying to express the fact that thanks to technology and progress, now our concerns are, I can't buy a PlayStation, right?
Have freedom. No, that's why it happened. You first worry about your existence, your food on the table and shelter. But once you have that, you want better things. You want education. You want freedom.
Sure.
So I think this is part why you see a lot of revolution right now. It's freedom of information.
Yeah, that's my point, I think. In the third world, now they're getting to that, you know, freedom. I'm saying third world. I mean, you know, maybe not third world, but they're getting to that stage. But here, even in our countries where there are a lot of problems, I don't want to say there aren't any problems, but our daily concerns are not, am I going to be able to buy food at the end of the month? Most of, you know, I'm sure those people also exist, but most people worry about, am I going to be able to, you know, buy that thing that I want that is going to be fun, you know? So
I'm going to lose weight, not gain weight.
Exactly, yeah, things like that. So basically, I'm just trying to say that I absolutely agree with you, and things are getting better and better every decade. And people who say things are getting worse, I don't know where they're coming from, and I don't know what... there are problems, but definitely less problems.
I might be over optimistic just because I spent 2 weeks ago some time in a new Google conference, the Solve4X conference, when they got us 50 people together and asked them, you know, how can you solve the biggest problem in the world? And I got, it was such an exciting time. So I think I got a shot of optimism in the arm.
So, yeah, let's talk about that for a second. We'll get back to other topics later, but that is definitely your, you know, local story. It's, you know, something that is very, very local to yourself, but it's also a thing that had global not implications, but that was covered globally. It's that new Solve4X, which is a sort of conference put together by Google, kind of like TED is the way that people described it. It's inviting people who have interesting things to say and amazing in amazing fields of research and asking them to speak for 15, 20 minutes and explain that to the world? Is that a fair representation of what it is?
Well, not exactly. So first of all, it's Solve4X. It's coming from Google X. It's their secret research part of Google. And it's different than TED because they had a specific agenda. You had to have a huge problem, a radical solution, and a breakthrough technology.
Okay.
That's what they're looking for. The X was in the middle of that. You have to address huge problems. So the huge problem people addressed was drinking water. It was food. It was, myself, sustainability with synthetic biology. It was education. And how radical solution coming from breakthrough technology that are happening now or will happen in the near future can solve those problems. And I encourage you to go to wesolve4x.com. That's a website, and listen to some of the talk. I think you'll be, you know, it was supposed to be more pie in the sky, not exactly pie in the sky, but more out there, you know, something that looks like science fiction, but it just might actually work. So I just encourage the audience to go there.
I'm saying it's a beautiful name for a conference, the phrase, Solve4X.
And it's like an equation, and for the speaker, they gave us a list of 10 actual equations, as, you know, Google being, you know, filled with geeks. So the equation was T equal 12, so you have 12 minutes, or limit your ego time one to, you know, for the time of the conference to zero. It was just an amazing, it was a list of actual 10 equations that you have to
So, abide by,
exactly. Yeah. It was so cool. And, you know, people say that Google is evil or not evil. Well, Google is just a corporation. And not like other people, I don't believe corporations are people. It's but the people in Google, they are, you know, evil, not evil. They are just geeks like us.
Yeah.
So, and it was great having, you know, speaking to Eric Schmidt and Sergey Brin, for example. Sergey talked how he, you know, when he wake up in the morning, goes to his self-driving car, press a button, and the car drive him to work. So, and his X, you know, everybody in the conference had the X, what they are solving for. So his X was magic. And, you know, magic, the same as Arthur C. Clarke said, that advanced, you know, if your technology
is advanced enough, it's indistinguishable from magic.
Exactly. And he said the self-driving car is just like magic. So, and they are trying to do similar things.
Can you tell us a little bit about, before we move on, can you tell us about your Soul4x talk?
Sure. So I just started a company a year ago. It's Genome Compiler. And what we are doing is trying to democratize the tools of creation, quite literally. So any of your audience that knows about computers know that computers understand binary codes, ones and zeros, but nobody writes computer software by typing ones and zeros. They use abstraction layer. They use tool to design, debug, and compile their code into software. And biology it's also information technology. And the computers, our cells, which are just living computers, they also understand code, A, T, G, and C of DNA. But people in my lab, you know, people in academia still write with ones and zeros. They still write with A, T, G, and C. So we are building the tools to design, debug, and compile biological software that can, you know, the great thing about biology is that the software writes its own hardware and then eats some sugar and self-replicate. And no computer can do that.
That sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, check the talk. I think I'm excited about this. And we're actually building it right now. So we raised money and we're building our software. So I encourage you to, if you're interested, to check it out.
So you go to WeSolve4x and you search for Omri Drori.
Yeah, or go to genomecompiler.com.
Both of them work. Okay,
so
excellent.
Does this have any connection at all to the synthetic beef competition that's been happening recently?
Synthetic beef?
Yes.
Oh, I heard about that. Somebody is trying to grow in vitro meat. Yeah, not exactly. Not exactly.
So yeah. You couldn't just surely you would be able to use this to program how you want to make beef, or, you know.
Oh yeah, in the future. So right now we can, you know, what the technology right now is that you can synthesize DNA. So just chemically synthesize it. So, and the world record right now is 2.3 million letters of code. It was a yeast chromosome, one of the yeast chromosomes that was done by the Johns Hopkins University. I think most people maybe recognize the Craig Venter Institute, or Craig Venter himself, that synthesized a million base pair, a whole bacterial cell. So the first living cell that... And they actually added information about a website. So this cell have a website address inside of its genome and cool things like that. So you can build single cells. You can start, the technology is where you can start actually constructing chromosomes, small chromosomes to...
That's all very interesting. But how long until you create some kind of mutant being that becomes self-aware and eats us all for, you know, food?
Well, you know, I have a baby. I don't want to kill people. I'm doing it for better reasons than that. But let's say 30 years.
Okay.
30 years. That gives us time.
Yeah.
30 years, yeah.
We have enough time to prepare.
Go ahead with the bomb, you know. I think we've got... That's...
Yeah, I was kidding, you know, joking with my team that I don't understand why Iran is spending so much money on nuclear bomb when they can just synthesize Ebola virus for... No, $3,000, but...
The problem with the Ebola virus is that you can't control it.
Exactly.
Once it's out, you might, you know, damage your own people too.
Yeah.
I guess.
Well, yeah. Also, throwing an atomic bomb, I think, will hurt their own people, but...
Yeah. No, of course, but yeah. Yeah, that's...
let's talk about the cool things. Let's talk about dragons and flying horses, not about Ebola viruses.
So you want to synthesize dragons and flying horses. Excellent.
I think it'll be cool, but no, I'm trying to do single cells that will produce biofuels or
that's
drugs.
Probably even cooler, actually.
That might be an application in the future, the ability to design one's own pet.
Well, yeah. You know, a dragon is very sustainable. It's a very sustainable mode of transportation.
Well, it depends. If it eats people, for example, it might be difficult, but we'll see.
Yeah.
It eats traffic.
That would be excellent.
That's a great market.
Two problems in one. So yeah. You solve for XX.
That's right.
And when you start solving for XXX, it's a whole different kind of industry.
And a kind of creature.
Also. Might have... okay, let's stop there. the other local story I wanted to mention, I mean, Kerwin is going to talk about the Queen in a little bit. Our French thing is the presidential election where President Sarkozy has finally declared for the presidential race. It was obviously a very... You know, it wasn't even a secret. Everyone knew that he was going to do it, and he did it a couple of weeks ago. There's been a lot of talk about what he is going to do, what he wants to do, what the other candidates are, you know, standard presidential race. There's no need to go too much into it. One thing I want to address, though, is the interesting... story with the Twitter censorship, quote unquote. There were a number of active fake accounts about Sarkozy on one side and about his message on the other. And when he declared, the main four, disappeared overnight. And there was a huge kerfuffle with the campaign management trying to explain what they had done, Twitter trying to explain what they had done, and the internet going wild saying that, you know, Sarkozy had censored Twitter, just like they do in China and just like, you know. So it seems that the campaign had asked for the removal of one account, which was the name was basically Nicolas Sarkozy with an underscore. So they said that this might be construed as, you know, this might be confusing, which I guess I can see. If you look for Nicolas Sarkozy and you see the account Nicolas Sarkozy, which is his real one that just opened, and the Sarkozy with an underscore, you might, you know, mistakenly follow the other one, and that might lead to confusion. There were a number of other accounts that were clearly marked as fake that Twitter went ahead and disabled anyway. They've restored the fake one with the name Sarkozy, and the guy who managed it changed the name, so now he's good. They have not, however, restored the other ones that had a name of his message, which is Strong France. They had things like, you know, My Strong France or things like that. And these ones have apparently not been restored. And the campaign claims that they haven't asked for the removal of those. I would tend to believe the Sarkozy side of things. People might tell me that I'm being naive, but he's been not encouraging critics, but there have been a few instances where there were satirical articles in newspapers, and he's always actively come out for, you know, saying that this was a strength of democracy. So I don't think, and also I don't think he would be, or his campaign would be, dumb enough to go and try to censor Twitter actively. Or maybe they did and someone got fired and that was the end of that. But yeah, there was a funny series of discussions happening after that. And there's another side to this also, which is that I believe it might be the campaign of Sarkozy that actually did it. When he opened his account a few days ago, a couple of weeks ago, you could find a large amount, maybe in the dozens, of accounts saying thank you for running it again, Mr. President. You know, thank you for doing something for us. And thank you for, you know, we're going to follow you. This is great. And of course, all of those accounts were, you know, named normally, but they all had been created a few days before. They had no profile picture, and they were following only one person, and that was Sarkozy.
It's so, just like the rally that Putin had, like
exactly. Exactly.
Very poorly orchestrated campaign, then, isn't it? I mean, if they're trying to get traction in social media, you can't start from a zero network. There's no leverage to get out of just putting an account online.
The interesting thing is our opinion in France is they're sort of at least getting interested in that. So most people, I mean, the others have accounts too. And by the way, apparently they do that too, the other candidates. But that's the state of online campaigning in France, I guess. Of course, that's marginal. There are, you know, a few, I don't know how many to this day, but there are people following both, you know, all the candidates on Twitter. That was sort of a funny kerfuffle.
So what's the major issues in France, the election? Who do you think is going to win?
So at the moment, the candidate from the left, he has close to 100,000 followers, as a side note. And let's see how many...
Can we just call the election by the number of Twitter followers? That would at least be a transparent election, right? We could replicate that model in all kinds of other places.
Well, the problem is, you know, they can create ridiculously fake accounts and follow people. So François Hollande, who is the candidate from the left, has 173,000 followers. So it would seem like, I think he's been online longer, but it would definitely
been online
seem
longer,
like,
and his followers might be younger.
Possibly, yeah. I mean, definitely the left side of the debate is usually, well, I don't know. It seems to me like they're younger and maybe a little bit more tech savvy, but who knows? Yeah. So to answer your question, Omri, it's basically the debate is, Sarkozy is trying to position himself very much above the fray. Obviously, he's an outgoing president, so everyone is attacking him on what he didn't do, which is absolutely a valid way of approaching things. Anytime he says, I will do that, people say, well, why didn't you do it before? You had 5 years. And it's a sort of awkward position to be in. The left, the main candidate who is probably going to be elected, François Hollande, the socialist. So I've expressed many times the fact that I'm more of a right-wing person in France, which makes me pretty much center anywhere else in the world.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm for social security, I'm for free education, I'm for, you know, all of that. And decent unemployment benefits, all of that. And Sarkozy is for all of that, too. So the left, in my opinion, I want to be very careful when I say this, the left in France is very much to the left on a world stage, or at least in the first world countries. So Sarkozy is the candidate of the right in France, but he would have center-leaning politics for the rest of the world. And he's basically in an awkward situation because he wanted to be the president of the purchasing power, giving more purchasing power to the French people. And he didn't achieve that, far from it. And he's trying to say, well, we had a couple of, you know, pretty major crises, and that's why I didn't manage to do that. I think a lot of maybe it would be interesting to ask you guys what you think. But my fiance was telling me Sarkozy actually did a very good job, because a lot of people in Europe and around the world were putting France in the same bag as you know, Greece, Italy, and Spain. And now France is looking like it's going to pull out. It's, you know, on that cusp. It's not completely doomed anymore in people's opinions. Do you guys agree with that vision, or was France always not in that same category?
I'm not sure if I ever thought it was doomed to begin with, but I think what has been interesting externally looking at France is that no news is good news. We haven't heard about really any kind of extreme rioting or extreme demonstrations, no huge civil unrest or political movements. We haven't heard about huge economic crises. It's been pretty calm in France, and that's a good thing.
And it was. It wasn't the situation you expected when the crisis started, I guess.
I guess that France being in the center of the euro and being like a lot of other governments, it's a pretty strong OECD first world economy, however you want to put it. It's the story of the French economy could parallel any of its neighbors. It could have looked like the UK, it could have looked like Germany, it could have looked like Spain or Italy. It could have gone any direction, and it hasn't. That's what I perceive from the news. There's an interesting thing which I could talk about, which maybe not a lot of people would give credence to, but one of the research projects that I'm working on at the moment is talking about the global city network, which are the cities that rule the world economy. And if you did that kind of analysis 3 or 4 years ago, you were basically saying that the world economy was run by London, New York, and Tokyo. And if you do it for 2009, which is the data set I had, it now looks more like London, Paris, and Tokyo. New York has slipped down to fourth place by a fairly big margin.
Interesting.
And so I put that together then with what I see happening with the big businesses that are based in France, and I see a lot of the French multinationals are expanding in the world markets. I think that there are a lot of French companies buying up a lot of the infrastructure in the UK. And one thing that I thought was particularly symbolic for me as an urbanist was to see the RATP logo on London buses. Now, to explain what that means to an international audience, RATP is the Parisian Transport Company, and they have recently bought out one of the privately held bus companies in London. So I think it's called London United. And it's been rebranded very subtly. There's no mention of RATP, but there's the logo of the Seine River that the RATP uses now sitting alongside the phrase London United on dozens of buses that we see every day. I don't think anyone in London knows or sees any significance in that whatsoever, but I think it's just one more small addition to, I pay my electricity and gas bills to EDF, GDF, for example.
Which is the French energy provider, yeah.
That's right. So for me, I think France economically has been positioning itself very well through this crisis. Its businesses have been very stable and they've been expanding sensibly and assertively. And maybe it's hard to see the benefit of that right now. I think that that has probably helped stabilize the French economy a lot. French economy could have been a bubble that popped, and I don't think it has, and I'm not sure it really will.
What about you?
I think that in Israel, when they talk about the euro crisis, they always talk about Germany and France as the main powers that discuss between them if to bail out this country or the next. So I think if I wear my Scott Johnson American hat, if you go back to the election, I think it's like, A, do the French have an election at all? And B, are they electing between stinky cheese and baguettes? I don't think they care or know the difference. And I think it's exactly what Corwin said. So if it's no news, it's good news.
So there are two. I don't want to dodge your question. There are two main things that Sarkozy is talking about. So the opposition is saying things like we need to hire more civil workers, civil servants, which to me seems like suicide. And they're saying we need to – one of the measures he is proposing is the generational contract, which would be if a senior worker – and by that I mean senior citizen going close to retirement wants to keep working, he can stay on in the company and work as a team with a young new hire. And in that to teach him the trade, and in that case, both of those would not have taxes attached to their salary for the employer. So the idea would be you lower the employer's taxes, and so he can employ both the senior guy and the young guy. So that would help on both sides. I'm not sure. I think this is like a stopgap because then when he's qualified, he goes back to being expensive for the employer. But the real problem of employment in France is that it's incredibly difficult to fire people. So as a consequence, people, you know, companies hesitate a lot to hiring people. So that's my interpretation of the matter.
I think Israel wish we had these problems going to election. I think our election is more, you know, if we're going to attack this country or are we going to lose our freedom and becoming a religious theocracy? I wish I had these kind of problems. Yeah.
Well,
I think that's quite an interesting policy, though. I think it sounds quite innovative, and it sounds like the kind of ideas that a lot of economies are going to have to start generating because of the aging population, and the fact that the welfare system aren't necessarily for
them. I'm not sure. I would need to check. I'm not sure he can go beyond the age of retirement, though. You know, it's not the senior guy can't go beyond the age of retirement. It's just that at the end, in order to keep him employed until the age of retirement, it's easier for, you know, the company to pass on the to pass the relay stick.
Why do people retire at all? That's a question I never understood. As being a scientist, my PI is 75 years old, and the last time I saw him, he was still cutting pea leaves to produce photosynthetic proteins. But, you know, if you like what you're doing, why stop?
Well, that's the thing. In France, so as you might know, Sarkozy had a very, very difficult fight to raise the retirement age from 60 to 62. And I think the rest of the world was looking at us thinking,
yeah, 67 are you insane? Or 65. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. It's like you want to retire, you're trying to raise it to 62 and this is a problem? It's people, you know, outside of France. Well, people in France don't understand. It's like they are very there was something about someone saying that you're not very familiar with the laws of arithmetic or you want to defy the laws of physics or something like that. And people in France don't want to abide by the laws of physics and arithmetics. Another thing that Sarkozy wants to do, which is somewhat controversial for a reason I understand, is that he wants to base the big decisions in the country. Oh, and by the way, about the retirement thing, I think the rating of the country would be a lot worse if he hadn't raised that age to 62. Now, no one is I think no one can claim that it was a bad decision now, even those who were protesting before, although I'm not sure.
You think it made that big a difference in the pension costs?
I think it makes any difference is good.
The aging of the population. I think 60 was a very old age. 100 years ago, the life expectancy of most people, I think, was 60 or 50.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. Another thing he wants to do is to get the big decisions for the country. He wants to have referendums to vote yes or no on the big decisions. And there is a fair deal of concern that this will, you know, for example, for the retirement, he would have wanted to have that referendum for these kinds of cases. Now, the other one he wants to do is he wants to make it so when you are unemployed, you have to follow an education course, and at the end of your education course, whatever the topic, you have to accept a job that the unemployment office will offer you. And on that, he wants to have a referendum. And what the people are saying that oppose this measure is that, of course, you can't ask the people to vote on a hot issue because they might not know enough about the issue. They might vote, on a very binary thing, for example, on the death penalty. They might not have voted to abolish it on the at the time on abortion. They might not voted to have it allowed or things like that, and so you can't decide. You can't decide on everything by referendum. It's a dangerous thing. And I understand that concern, although a lot of countries do that from time to time, and it works. You know, you have to trust the people too, and that's what he's saying. I think the reason, the semi-hidden reason why he wants to do it is to bypass the incredibly powerful unions in France that are not a force, in my opinion, not a force of negotiation, but a force of blocking negotiations. And he wants to have that weapon as a threat so that the unions have to accept some things or to, lower their demands, some of them, because it's very difficult to do anything in France because of those unions. The thing is, unions are not mandatory. You don't have to be unionized. So only the most extreme people are part of unions. And in that case, you get the unions that have a very little legitimacy over the general the overall worker force, but that have a lot of power. So since he can't really change the unions, they have become too strong and too corporatist. He's using that referendum as a strength against them. And that's one of the main things he's discussing. All right. Anyway, we're going to have a lot more of that. The election is in two months, and we'll have many occasions to talk about them in the show. Let's unless you have comments about this. No?
No.
All right. Let's move on and finish the show with Diamonds and Queens and Long Reigns with Kerwin.
Diamonds and Queens and Long Reigns. Yes. Queen Elizabeth's Diamond Jubilee. So I'm not sure exactly what the date is. It sort of gets chopped and changed around anyway. There are all sorts of dates to commemorate with Queen Elizabeth, but this year she has been on the throne for 60 years. I think that's the story. So her Diamond Jubilee. So this ought to be a momentous occasion. She's one of the longest reigning monarchs in the world. In a few years' time, she'll be the longest reigning monarch who's ever reigned in Britain when she passes Queen Victoria's record of 63 or 64 years, I think it is. But so what would be a fitting celebration for a queen on this occasion? Well, according to the Minister of Education, perhaps the people of Britain would like to show their gratitude by buying her a £2 million yacht.
Oh, no.
Wait, how does the Ministry of Education fit in that story?
Oh, he's just the guy that proposed it.
Oh.
He's the man that proposed it to Cabinet.
What? Oh, really?
Yeah, this is what, you know, in a time of austerity, when we're laying waste to the National Health Service, when we're privatizing the education system wholesale, we should do is give the Queen a yacht to replace the one that went out of commission a few years ago when it got too old. So, right. You know.
I can only imagine that news was greeted by much embarrassment by the Queen herself. Surely she must be like, wait, I don't really need a £2 million yacht.
I think she can afford.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, the Queen doesn't express embarrassment.
No, of course, yeah.
And the Queen actually is not really capable of embarrassment. The only thing that is possible is that someone else is embarrassed because they've created embarrassment around the Queen. The Queen is always above it all. It's for the minister himself to be embarrassed. That is the proper protocol.
So is he embarrassed?
No, it seems that he's merely batty. Just completely out of touch with the public, completely out of touch with what the austerity package
means. Even how has it's funny, we heard about the Jubilee, of course, briefly, but we don't really care for, you know, crowned monarchs. But how was that news? Was there a scandal or what happened?
Well, the funny thing is that he was just sort of told to keep mum that it probably wasn't the best idea. That was the nice way that Cameron put it. You know, probably not right now. Yeah. And that was sort of the end of it. He was pretty much told to keep shush, I think.
Okay.
I have an image of a privileged, English nobleman saying, "Oh, £2 million, that's so cheap."
Well, that's right. In some ways, it really is. So, but the funny thing is what happens with the same education minister the week after, I believe it was, when it was revealed that he had attempted to purchase for the schools of Britain a warehouse full of Bibles. And he was going to distribute these to all of the schools as using Department of Education funds. And he'd sort of gone ahead with it without going through the proper expenditure protocols. The Bibles have been sitting there. The funding has not been allotted for their distribution. And so they've just been sort of waiting. And again, it's a case of exactly what kind of social movement or conservative, not the Conservative Party, but what kind of organization is behind a man who is proposing these things. It was revealed, for example, that the yacht was an idea that there had been a small group of businessmen and other people, other organizations planning this campaign to buy this yacht for the past 3 years, and then what's driving this idea that we need to start kind of Americanizing the British culture and have this proselytizing of Bibles across the schools, etc. It's an absolute wonder that he didn't have to resign spectacularly in either of those 2 weeks.
Hmm. All right. Well, I guess that is going to be the funny news that is also going to conclude this episode. Anything else you guys want to add? We've, of course, once again gone well beyond the 1 hour I was expecting, but you know, I don't know what's wrong with, you know, 1 hour. It has to gravitate around an hour and a half anytime we do anything, no matter how many things we talk about. It's weird.
It was a pleasure to be here again, and thank you for inviting me. I just encourage, if anybody is interested in synthetic biology, to check it out. Go to genomecompiler.com and watch the talk, and just go to the Sol4X. There is a lot of inspiring talks.
Cool. Excellent. Thank you. Do you have any, you know, Twitter accounts or stuff like that that you want to pimp?
Sure. It's Omri_Drory, D-R-O-R-Y. And I'm on Google Plus now, and I have to. They actually gave me an audition to the Google X on in the Hangout. So I had to get an official Google Plus account.
Of course.
But I'm there also. So just my name. Check it out.
Cool. Excellent. Thank you, Omri. What about you, Kerwin? Do you still do stuff in the architecture field?
In the architecture field. I don't design buildings. I do write about them occasionally. But the biggest thing that I do, apart from my research, is the Global Urbanist, which is an online magazine analyzing cities and urban policy issues around the world. So that's globalurbanist.com, or you can follow it on Twitter, Global Urbanist, or on Facebook and all other kinds of media streams.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Kerwin. For myself, you'll find everything at patrickbeja.com. And I think that's going to be it for this show. We will be back next month with another set of interesting people and interesting news. So we hope to see you then. Bye, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. We'll be right back.
part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.